This reel is Emerson number 3, back in the second quarter. I'm going to transfer now from the third quarter, the last day in the third quarter, the 31st Friday, the 31st of May. Friday the 31st of May. Over to this reel. And this is Channel 2. I don't remember now whether it's right or over. Channel 2 on Emerson Reel number 3. Emerson Reel number 3 is from the second quarter 1968, and I'm transferring now the last day of the third quarter 1968, May the 31st on Friday, the last day.
Business, really. And I'll try to move along. One point that we're talking almost all together, I'll talk with you now about the examination. You know, it takes a while to sort of get into harness. You know what I mean by harness? To get so you can work together a little bit. I see you come up to me and say you failed to do something. I may have done it a dozen times, see, but that's your approach, you see. Well, now, you see, I like that. That's fine. I expect that. Now, let me work you out just a little bit. Now, suppose somebody asks you what the Emersonian points are, what would you say? Now, you use your paper, just rough notes now. I want you to make it sort of systematic, halfway systematic. Now, you see, he bases it all on some principle within the individual. And what it is in the world outside, you see, that makes it possible for that light to exist in the individual. Now, you say that's a metaphorical way. That's all. That's well enough. Doesn't matter. And I think the safest approach is the one he takes first in self-reliance. He gives it a negative definition in terms of society. Now, you see, he may love society. It doesn't matter about that. You don't have to hate society and understand it. And he picks out those points about society that obstruct the individual. Now, you see, conformity. Now, you set these down, society. Now, it's society, and these aspects of society, you see, what he does, use society as too big a word by itself, and what he's trying to do is make it be able to handle it, find a handle. And conformity is one of the points. Consistency is something demanded of society. Well, you see, there's nothing wrong with consistency. It's a useful thing. If you run an office or have a little business, you see, you have to be there and be the same every day. But this is not a business that, you see, he's running. It's not the mercantile view that he's taking here. So consistency is what hinders you. Now, from science, or you might say the sciences, he takes these two points, logic and classification. Logical approach is one based on knowledge and I don't know what else. But I found out long ago, you see, that I was not logical. And furthermore, that anyone who was logical made me feel uncomfortable. And whenever anybody starts to say it stands to reason, then I get small and start to disappear. Now let me work this out. I'm just saying all over again what we've said several times. Classification is a part of science that you don't like because you have to memorize it. You have to use it. You don't mind it in a table as long as you don't have to get it in your own mind. I like it in that little bird book Because if I see a new specimen, I can sort of look it up in there and find out a name for it. But after I find a name, I've classified it, and it loses its novelty. And I salt it down then. And that's what he says about classification. Classification is deadly. The whole process is deadly. And NASA, you see, the space agency, when they talk about all these things, they give you their way of life is classification. And if you find any deadlier documentary, I don't know where you'd find it, unless it's from the Smithsonian. Now, you listen to some of those documentaries and just see how deadly they are. Why, you know, I listen, you know, you know whenever I get sort of excited, I'm not mad at anybody. I'm just sort of pursuing this subject with you. I like that little children's program on Channel 5. See, Channel 5 is the educational program channel. It comes on at 7 o'clock. That's about time I eat supper. And they have a program called What's New, and I like to see those little figures march out, you see, and they play that little music. I love to hear that. Well, one of the finest of the scientists who appear on that is Merle Lucene. Oh, he's rich. But one of the dullest things I ever saw anyone do, he did it. You know what he did? He went through geological time giving one mastodon after another. And he pointed out the picture of them in the Smithsonian. Well, after three, they all looked alike. Some of them might be 5 feet and some of them 50. But it's all the same, you see. He's using that classification. You can't, you see, it's limited. Now you know that. Now that's Emerson and all of these people that we work with are coming up against the scientific method. And they see, the technology, the useful side of it, but they're actually not much interested in the useful side of it. A great deal of technology is just useless. It just encumbers the world. And it'd be mighty fine if we could just dispense with about 9/10 of it. Well, now that's two approaches that he has in order, you see, he's two approaches. One through science and one through society. Now look here. Here's another approach. This is another way the mind works. Now you can put this down on your papers. You see, your mind works through categories. Through the categories, depends on how your mind works. Now, I think most people in their unenlightened state say they have opinions on a subject. Well, now, opinions is something that just gets a man in trouble. You see, what he wants to do is take some approach to it. Now, that's what Emerson does, you see, in his approach to this. Now, look here. I'll give you an example of a question, a sort of academic question that I would ask in the second half of your examination. This is a fair question. One part of the education of a scholar, as he talks about it in The American Scholar, is books, the past. But see, that says nothing whatever. Because most books he excludes. So it has to be that Emersonian view of books and of reading for it to make sense at all. Now you see, I'm not asking you for your opinion. I'm not asking you for knowledge, actually. You could do this. You could say, what is it, if Emerson says it's the past in books, which is one part of the education of the scholar, what does he mean by it, and what is that, you see? In other words, what's the Emersonian view of books? Now, you can work it out. And you see, you get outside the realm of opinion. And you don't go around saying, what do you think about Emerson? What do you think about Senator Kennedy? And to be fair now, you see, Vice President, former Vice President Nixon. Now, let me run through this. You're not saying what he thinks.
It seems to me he's saying what his observations and the observations that he has gotten, which are certainly his opinion, unless he's God, and it's absolutely true.
No, it's not his opinion. It's his point of view.
Well, what is the difference? Isn't an opinion a point of view that is expressed?
No. Opinion, just some little old I believe.
Well,
just as useless, you see, as the credo is.
It seems to me that...
Oh, you don't believe the same thing every day.
But it seems to me what he is saying in here is, this is what I believe, but I've worked it out. It isn't right off the top of my head. It's an opinion, but it is one that is worked out.
Well, now let's take another key. Now, here's another good question for you, the second part. This is a good academic question. In the Divinity School address, what's it called in your book? An address? What he does is take his regular approach over into religion. All right. What's the result of it when he takes it over into religion? You can tell. You can make several statements about it. Now, it's not opinion. You see, it's taking the approach.
The difference between opinion and taking an approach, other than Emerson's approach, is well worked out.
No, I don't think it's well worked out. I think he's half-baked half the time. Doesn't know what he's talking about.
I know it's well.
But you see, what it does is opens the question.
Okay.
And opinions close the question.
What?
That's what opinions do.
Well,
you
that.
All get together in here, you see, and you start, every one of you sowing your opinions, and first thing you know, all you've got is a pot full of mixed opinions which don't add up to anything. But now look, if you take that Emersonian approach and say, now apply this to religion, it opens up the field for everybody to go along together. Now let me you can make your statement. You see, the simplest thing would be to apply it to the good book. But you see, in Emersonian view, there is no such thing as a good book. There's no book that's good. It's got to, you see, the book has got to still be like that Emersonian book in the American Scholar. So you can take it over. Oh, the good book's deadly, in part. You've got some of the dullest writers in the whole world that ever breathed in that good book. But you know, he wouldn't make that good. Now, you know,
The good book is a book of opinion, unless you believe in divine revelation. I'm not going to argue religion, but...
Well, they've got a little different categories. They're not Emersonian. But now, take that. Let me... I'll tell you what. Find it now from the... See, my trouble is, after I know something there, I still can't find it. Yes, and see if it makes sense. I can't quite find it. Jesus belonged to the true race of prophets. He saw with open eye the mystery of the soul, drawn by its severe harmony, ravished with its beauty. He lived in it and had his being there. Alone in all history, he estimated the... Alone in all history... He estimated the greatness of man. Now that's an Emersonian approach to religion. Alone in history, Jesus estimated the greatness of man. One man was true to what is in you and me. So you see, that end of Emersonian view is, you see, in that old, you know what Dimmesdale did? He, what was the word? He put himself, what do you call it?
Scourge,
flagellation. Oh, that's one of the sad chapters in the human race, you see? That picture of a man, of flagellations, of man scourging himself. whipping himself with a knot and a rope and making the blood come. That's one of the sad things. Now, you see, now let me tell you, you don't have an opinion on that. That's a viewpoint. You don't say that's right or it's wrong. I believe this, I don't believe this. You pursue that idea to see where it leads you. And one direction it leads you is this. Don't explain anything on a supernatural basis that you can explain in a human. You see, the human will take you a long ways if your mind works.
What you're saying then is the difference between a viewpoint, for example, Emersonian viewpoint here, and an opinion, is that a viewpoint doesn't imply a belief of right or wrong.
That's right. He's pursuing it. Right. Now, you see, that's the very first thing he said in Self-Reliance. Whoso would be a man must be a nonconformist. He who would gather mortal thorns must not be hindered by the name of goodness, but must inquire. You see, the whole basis of Emerson's viewpoint is the inquiry. Well, now look, you say that's not sufficient. A man's got to live in society. All right, that's true. And that's different from the Emersonian view. But it doesn't preclude it. So it's not a matter of opinion, it's your approach. That I would say a person can pursue questions every now and then and still live in society, can't it? Still work the dime store.
Except that Emerson is saying that society doesn't allow us. They punish us for the voices we hear. Because usually they judge that the voices come from below. And if man wants to live without being punished or without a sour face, he's not allowed to pursue questions.
Well, now there you are, you see. There you are. There's society. That's an inevitable part of society. Now look, you say, what is society? You see, the most immediate part of society to you is the institution here. And I guess different from that, you see, the form of society that you know the most of all, what form of society do you know the best of all? See, you don't think of it as a form of society, social institution, the family. And you see, nothing has so low a mental horizon as a family. I don't know anywhere anyone will find such meaningless chatter as in a family. Go ahead. And that's a social institution. That's what he's talking about. Well, that's, you know.
It's very meaningful, the chatter that goes on in a family, because it's the chatter that goes on around your household and around your immediate family that shapes what you become.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't say that it's meaningful.
Well, you see, that's not my view of it. That's the Emersonian approach. The family is still a social institution. Now, what you going to do? Just govern your family so you've just got endless chatter, or are you going to govern it along Emersonian lines? Taking notes. And you'll ask me, you'll see me down the street, and then you say, you fail to explain to us what Emerson means. Like you're writing to see it, you say you failed to include the pair of shoes that I ordered. You just sent the jeans. Now look. Now see, if you set these points down where you can hang on to them when you get home, I think that's one point, you see, in the Emersonian approach, is that one gets a point of view and not opinions. So a little you just person can't talk when you sit around giving opinions, you see. Then you've got to step on somebody's toes all the time. Can't talk. But if you could get a viewpoint, it opens up the subject. As if anybody knew the answers, no one knows the answers, you see. What you want to do is get into it. Okay. Now, you see, first and last, you've had so many, you see that Emersonian approach in different ways. Now, you see, Whitman showed it to you. He brought it to they all do it. They all do it. You see, in every last one of these writers, you have the artistic question. Each one of them has to work out his own form of art. Poe, in that little poem I read to you yesterday, no one had ever written in that kind of poem before. It just fit his purpose. Now, you see, the hard thing about Emerson is he won't organize. He won't be logical. One thing sort of runs into another. He talks about something a while, and he talks about something else a while. Now, you see, if he would organize his material the way I'm doing it for you, it'd make it a little bit, you see, what I'm doing, I'm reducing his first thoughts into organized second thoughts. Now, this question of art, you see, that has to go down. That just has to go down as one of the parts. Now, look, here's another part of it, art, put on that red art. Now, here's another view of it. I don't know quite how this works, but I don't know whether you'd call this a part of the Emersonian view or not. I don't know, but they all do it. It's what I call polemic. It's quarreling with the reader. Thoreau starts off baiting the reader, you know. He says, like Chanticleer, he's going to crow, if for no other purpose, and to wake up his neighbors. Disturb them, you see. But he doesn't do anything at all compared to Whitman. Whitman says, do you think I want to shock you? And the answer is, yes, I know, that's all you want to do. In some cases, it just shocked me. And he brings in all those matters of nakedness, you see, and perspiration, and sweat, and armpits. Just to shock you. And he says, you see, a rose is not a rose. This running blackberry is... the dawn, the parlors of heaven. Just shocking, that's all I see. Now that's what I call that polemic quality. I don't know whether that would be part of it or not. Now what else you want to say about those Emersonian poems? Will that hold you for a while? I'll tell you what I'd want you to do. I'd want you to be able, I'd want to write two or three of those on the board and then let you take one of them and work it out in some of the writers. See, what is the artistic question that Whitman raises and Poe raises and one to the other? Just any of them would do the same thing, you see. Just any of them. Those hanging. But I think I've sort of said in a offhand way, time two, made statements about it. Now, you want me to work it out in a logical pattern for you, just like how I'm doing this? Yes. And then ask it to you on the exam. So all you're doing, you see, is just feeding yourselves on abstractions. And you see, that's against all of them. You see, all of them discredit the validity of any abstraction. It's the objects that bring from diffusion my thoughts and experiences. Well, now let me see. What I would say, the part I'm most interested in is the part I said you could do about yourself. Now this, you see, it would exist in your own mind. This would be the course as it appears to you. But those perceptions, as you go along, as to who Hester really is, and what usher really amounts to. Those things that come to you, even though somebody explains it to you, it doesn't necessarily mean anything, does it, at the time. Somewhere along the line, it has to come to you. Those little illuminations all along the line. I see that's your private light, so to speak. I think that would make them, I think that would be the most interesting thing you could do. I ask you another question. This is a little academic question. Let me tell you. Would you mind if I didn't ask you questions, but just make a statement and let you work on the statement? You see, the mind doesn't work in terms of questions. The mind works in terms of a statement. The statement's the inquiry. Now, let me write a statement on the board. In the term of screw, evil is unspecified. And as I said to you yesterday, according to the Mr. What's-His-Name, who is a resident, writer in residence here, that makes it so much stronger. If you think the boy was in a crab game, you see, it may be a serious offense, but it's nothing that has to do with the predestination. Now, evil is unspecified. Now, that would be an artistic thing. That'd be an artistic view of it. And I think what you'd want to do there is to show that unspecified evil is strong. Another view of it, and this is much less interesting. This is just a matter of reading closely. Evil is specified, and we find out precisely what the little boy did. I see, that's a little different type of question. But now, why can't I write that on the board? In the screw, evil is specified. Instead of going all around the bush, you see, in order to make something of it. Now, what I'd ask you for there, see, is information to find out in the rest of the book where you find out what the boy did at school when he was expelled. Whitman is the only one who loiters. He's the only one who loiters. Give cases in the reading where Whitman does loiter and talk about that. And then take it to the other writers and see how they would stand on it. Talked about that one day in class, and it's the way he opens the song of myself. I sit and loaf. Maybe loaf would be a better word. Loaf. I sit and loaf and look at a spear of summer grass. Loaf. See what you do there. You see, let me tell you. What that the validity of a statement like that is, it enables you to look at Whitman and see what he does when he says, I loaf and invite my soul. And then look at Thoreau when he seems to do the same thing and see kind of what the process is. But you don't have to compare them. Comparing them is logical.
No, no kind of statement. You're not going to give a statement. You're going to give a statement and, you know, discuss it and show whether you're right or wrong or has any validity. Does it apply to others?
Well, now you see, when I say a statement, this would be a sort of philosophical way of inquiry. A statement, a philosophical term, is an inquiry. And what it does is take an idea through a body of evidence, examine the evidence in terms of that question. I see what I do to the paper. So I'll make statements about both of them. And then follow the statement. And you see, that idea, the inquiry, gives you something to hang on to. It's not logical.
but it's an idea to hold on to. Makes good sense.
You know, just while you're sort of thinking, I don't think the Emersonian approach would work in any institution. For instance, in Sunday school, I don't think it would be permitted to take a position of doubt. I think it's mostly affirmation. They want to defend the establishment and show that prayer is what St. Augustine said it was. Any organization. It may be that this approach is not practical in an organization, in any organization. I don't know. Committee meetings ought to be like this, batted around. Now here, you see in your bull sessions, you say, well, it's nice in class, but it's not like a good bull session. I find classes much more satisfying to me than bull sessions. Bull sessions, I find them tedious. Because it's opinions. They're working on opinions. You see, the method is not quite up to this approach.
Yeah, when you get into a classroom situation, professor stands up and gives you, this is true, and this is why it is true, and you can inquire all you want, but this is the truth. So inquiry is sort of useless.
Yeah. He thinks he's giving you what you want, you see. He thinks that's what you want.
Well, it's easier for him than to try to make him think. Because if people question, then he or she has to think about what he's trying to teach. You know? And that involves work. And many instructors don't want to work any more than I do.
Well, it works both ways, you know.
Yeah.
It works both ways. Anyhow, now here, you know, now here. This would be a marvelous thing for you to use. I say take the one of these Emersonian points, you see. Now take the one about conformity. Now what you want to do, I'd do it for you. And you wouldn't have to write on this, I'd give you a choice. I'd say that none of these writers seek nonconformity. In other words, once nonconformity is sought, It just results in a man with short hair, long hair, and but you see, what it does is not a. There's no set question to it. It will still open it up for you. Thoreau does. Maybe when I say polemic, I mean this: that Whitman and Thoreau both are seeking nonconformity. By shocking and crowing. I don't know. But you've got enough evidence, you see, to examine and go a long ways. And it's one thing that we always leave out, you do in class, you feel it's not objective, it's your own experience. Most of the papers I read, I'm really not interested in them because the writer never gives his own experience. I don't know how it fits him. Sort of an abstract world that's way out there. That exists. Take that evil. Now look at this. Evil, 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 evil is specified. Evil, 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 evil. Now look. You see, now that's not a specific question. That opens up a lot, but you still have to push it yourself. Now look, I could make that a little more academic in this way, and it may be that if I do not make it academic, you have to make it academic or logical in your statements. I'm not sure. Let me give you an example. In terms of the school, there are three or four steps in the attitude of the governess, the attitude that the governess takes toward the children. Now, the first one is what the critics call innocence, like the Garden of Eden, of innocence. See, the old religious biblical term is taken over. And you see now the extreme. At the end, they are just utter evil. No innocence left. And the little boy or the little girl. So now what you want to do is take in the middle now and see what the point is. Do you remember in your mind? I don't know whether you can or not. See, you better read it than I am. When I read this, I couldn't remember that. Now, as I read along, I could sort of remember where that attitude changes. But this book is so intense, so sustained, I get into a new position, forget what the old one was. Do you remember that one time where she... I read it to you in here somewhere, sometime. Read you that little passage. Where she says she will watch them. She will watch them to see if there's any evidence. And the first thing she does is find some that they are practicing duplicity. And her evidence is, when she goes out there, they find a reason to go off and leave her and play by themselves so they can talk to Quinn. And she uses the word contrive. And that's a negative word, you see, pejorative word in that sense. And then at the lake, you see, in the question I asked you on the test, that's bad. So you actually, you see, evil. Now look, there's no doubt that what there is element of evil, certainly, in human nature. Now you do it in James, the school. Why don't you do it in your own experience? Now, this is what I think. This is the way I see evil. This is my experience of evil concerning you. You see, if I didn't contrive to avoid that, see, what you do would come in here every day reading that darn newspaper and smoking cigarettes and fouling the air. Now, I call that utter depravity. Now, that's evil. I can go home and say, look at those things, people, those animals I have to deal with up there. I can do it just like the governess, especially if you make me mad. Or if you get me in a corner. And I've been in a lot of academic corners. I'd respond just like the governess. You see, I'd feel that same Freudian quality of anxiety, and I'd start saying nasty things and seeing nasty things. Now, when you read that little, those two or three little Emerson's essays, I know one or two of you came up and asked me, is this all we're going to read? As much as say we didn't have much Emerson. All of you wondered about that. You had that whole big thick book, and all I asked you to read was one or two little essays. But now, you see, this is the last day. Unless I held a stick over you, I wouldn't have a quorum in here today. The last day, we'd just drink Coke. That's all you do. Have no reason. Oh, you may come in here and tell me your grandmother's lost something. Or you've lost your grandmother or something. see, this is last day. And I have held you to the line right up to the last day, and I'll hold you to the line right up to that exam. And if you don't do well on that exam, you won't do well in the course. One of my best friends, not long ago, made B's on everything during the term. And she didn't open a book on that exam, and it was just as crackpot as anything I ever read. She came up and asked me how she made a C. And I thought to myself, sister, if I hadn't done any better than you did, I wouldn't even want to see you. You didn't do anything. It was shameful. Just empty-headed. You see, I'm holding you to it right up to the tail end. Yeah. Yeah, but I'm not logical, you see. If I were logical, I couldn't teach Emerson. But now look here. You have read, let me tell you. You see, you have read one or two, let me tell you, one or two little essays of Emerson, and you know what they've done to you? You see, when you go home and talk now, your old papa and mama won't even recognize you. They have transformed your whole view of the world and yourself. And what I want to see on that examination, especially the first part of it, I want to see the evidence of it. I want to see how you have reacted to all this fine material, just case by case, as you go along. What are you picking up your books for? Now, don't ask me a question. Ask me a question after class. Now, you don't want an anticlimax now.
Yeah.
Let me. I've got you through to the exam. Now, let me see if you got your papers. I can't think of anything else. I'll see you.
Go ahead.
I've got one at the office. I didn't bring it. Just hold it and put it down there.
A long grade.
You've got all the grades I've got.
Yeah, not long.
And you can't tell what they are, you see, because you don't know what they're for.
Last topic, suppose we do react negatively to that. Would you accept that reaction if we can?
Oh, you can't that? React negatively to anything. You want to swing. What do you call it? With your material.
Yeah. Equipment is the only one who orders. Suppose we feel that other authors do order.
Well, that's it. You just get into there and swing with your
material. But then we would be allowed to feel that way. And
you can't help it. You got to swing with your material. But what it does is give you a view so that you can see a little more clearly what they are doing. And if I don't know just what Thoreau is doing, I'd love to see that would enable me to get into it a little bit more. You know, I have misplaced your paper. I've remembered it. Don't you know you handed me that paper? It's in here somewhere, but I haven't forgotten it. I haven't ignored it.
Okay, well, would you like me to write another one?
No, I don't want you to write another one. I'll run across it.
Okay.
But I just want you to know I hadn't forgotten it. Just ignored it.
Have you handed any of them back, though?
I've handed everything back but that.
Well, the other people are just turning those in right now.
What's that?
The other people are just turning those in.
All the papers I had are right there. I'm not abstracting. You want me to make abstractions?
No, I'm the one that makes the abstractions.
Huh?
I'm the one that makes the abstractions.
I just talked to you. I picked out this case that I thought was abstract.
So I'm with your opinion, and you're the teacher.
Oh, that's it. You know, that one case. Man? No, man. Where's your paper? Let's look at it a little bit. I'm interested in it.
Hmm?
I'm interested in it.
She she asked me about a paper. I had said, you know, that she had made the statement, you know, that they did, their talents and perceptions did flower, but then she didn't let them flower. And she, what she did actually was show me that she picked out the highest point at which they flowered. And in Hester, for instance, sort of the crux of the matter was Hester's strengths to confront Chillingworth. And that's right, although it's a rather limited way of handling the material, that's that symbolic way that she learned last term.
Just the end of the course and go backwards, it'd be nice.
Yeah, well, now I think we're ready for the course, all of us, to take it again. Some of us, that is, like the Greek material. But we weren't ready then, and it's like anticlimactic for use in one period, and stand up here and tell us what the Emerson point is. And what really bothers me, I mean, it offends me greatly, and that's why I'm so upset, is because why do you think you have to tell us now, just before we take the test, which doesn't, so we're going to prove to you that we've learned something. It's ridiculous. If we haven't gotten it by now, if you hadn't told us before, what difference does it make if you tell us the Friday before the test what you want us to put on the test?
Yeah.
And I think Thoreau and Emerson would be highly disturbed at what you did today. Very much so.
You think they wouldn't want, they'd be against it?
Well, apparently, it seems to me that the reason it was done is that, sort of to clarify things at the last.
I understand pretty well what she, how she feels, and I remember one of the earliest cases of that was when Wade Twycourt and one of my other friends were doing this reading, and the thing had been opened up, and there's sufficient time, you see, to work out these points, and they're supposed to come to you, you see, as experiences and perceptions, and not be lined out in this academic abstract way.
Also, in view of the fact that we do have an exam on Friday, this the fear of this looms especially large in the minds of students. And it's very benevolent of you to give us what you want. But to some of us, that exam is going to be very, very important because it determines their grade, if they value that grade. And they're, I guess, grateful. Concerned what they make. It's a travesty, the whole thing. Because now that I can vaguely see what I was sort of grasping at for the whole quarter, I'm not really concerned with what I make on that test. I mean, I'll try when I, and I'll try to do some extra reading next week. But because I may not give you what you want on the test does not mean that I wasted a whole quarter at all. And I'm not going to judge my own performance on what grade you give me.
Well, this whole point of view goes against the academic system.
Yes. After all, what are you asking for? You're asking for us to classify, right, and to categorize, and to give you knowledge back, memorize statements of what they actually said. It's very hard to convey in words, because words don't express that feeling that you want us to give you. It's very hard to do.
Half of it, just half of it is informative. Half of it is yours.
I wasn't here on Wednesday. I don't understand. You mean part of the exam is our opinion or our experiences in relation to...
You weren't here on Wednesday. I talked half an hour.
I wasn't here.
I had 2 days to talk about the exam.
Well, are we going to be adequately prepared for it then? My students are going to go take an exam, and I've spent 10 weeks in an effort to get across to them so something which I thought was very important. It would be a tremendous disaster to me if when I read those exams, they did not say what I wanted them to say. If all those papers showed were, what did you say, absenteeism, indolence, and incompetence.
No, I didn't say that.
Yes, but that's what you were talking about, students.
No,
I didn't. The implication was you are students, and therefore you are incompetent, indolent, and absentee.
Yeah.
And,
that came out in Time magazine.
Oh, yeah, well.
That's David Reisman. I have had a good bit of absences.
Yes,
he
has.
Pretty regular.
It's very difficult for somebody to force themselves to come to class if they don't really understand what's going on in class, including when they haven't read the material.
Yeah.
And what's more, most of the stuff is entirely irrelevant to their existence.
Just a freshman.
Yes.
I think a year up here makes a difference. Now, you see, if you did this same thing a year from now, it would strike you a little differently.
It might. I have no idea where it
might. I would never work with freshmen on this material. I'd rather
what
have...
What do we lack that supposedly sophomores have?
You see, you're bright and you're gifted, you see. I don't know what it is. Maturity, experience.
Well, from my observation and my experience, it is true that in certain cases, some sophomores, maybe as a whole, a classroom full,
mm-hmm.
would seem more mature. But individually, I don't think I'm being conceited by saying that I feel myself adequately competent to handle the same material as anybody else in this classroom, with maybe a few exceptions. There might be 5 to 10 kids who are obviously more mature than I am and probably look at this from a completely different point of view. But the average sophomore that sits in here does not have anything over me.
No, and might be inferior. But you put it this way, this time next year, you'd handle it in a considerably different way.
Are you suggesting I take the course over again?
But a year's academic experience, I guess it's been away from home or whatever it is. I think it makes a big difference. I'd rather have juniors and seniors. I think that's one difficulty. I did change a good bit this time. This is not really the way I would handle this material. But you see, the material invites this approach. The registration is something has happened to the registration where there's not enough older people in the classes. If I had 3 or 4 older people, it'd make a big difference. I've seen that. It really makes a difference. You see, all of you about. That may be the machine doing it. I don't know.
Just people that signed up for it.
I don't know what it is.
I was reservations, so that's why I'm taking this English.
Mm-hmm. Well, now you read well and you write well. And just about all I've done, you see, is use sort of Emersonian tricks, techniques with you.
Well, the thing is, we can't see that they're tricks or not because we don't even know what the approach is, really. And like several things you said today about the artistic inquiry and science and the scientific method against that and the idea of loafing. Well, now, if I had, you know, if you had said this 3 weeks ago, I could sit down and I'd have an afternoon.
You see, here she reverses her ground. She says if she'd had this some time ago, her outlook would have been different. In other words, if I had reduced all this material to these abstractions and, you know, put it in the academic manner, or Emerson calls it second thoughts, she could have responded to that, see. And that's what I did today. I just couldn't take any chance any longer, you see, that they had to get it then or not at all. And they had to respond to some of those second thoughts, those abstractions. And she's the same way about it. I withheld it as long as I could.
But you're hitting it at the wrong time, because this is finals week. And nobody has the free time or the presence of mind to even do that. Because we've lost our presence of mind for a whole week at least.
Yeah, that's right.
And, you know, this is, it's just like, well, these are fine footnotes, but they should have been the main material. It's like when somebody writes a paper, and they put everything that should have come at the beginning at the end, you know, as their summary. But meanwhile, they sort of meander in the beginning. And that's my feeling right now. I felt like all the things you had to say, I think that some are very worthwhile. I think there's a lot in there. But I'm really, you know, I can just see them, I can observe them, and I can say, that looks as though they're, you know, if I were to spend a lot of time and work it all the way through, as you say, I'd probably, you know, emerge with some kind of mosaic of what the whole thing was. But it's too late right now.
You know, I'll tell you what. I don't know when I found this out. But one time I found it out. I think I forget just the key. It's been several years. I thought all term, I've never had such a sorry group of students to work with. And somehow or other, and I don't know why, I kept plugging away. But now this is what I... And this happened one time. I went clear up to the last day in a course, and never made any dent at all until the very last day. And all at once it opened up. And I just sort of put that down as an article of behavior. That I don't care what sort of group I'm in. I don't care what it is. I'm not going to give up. I'm going to work as hard as I can on it every day. If the group doesn't work, I'm still going to work hard on it. I'm going to needle them. I'm going to push them. I'm going to do my share of the work. I'm going to do it right up to the bitter end, right up to the examination. And you know, I have found sometimes that these little illuminations don't come through until the final exam. Now, that's not theoretical.
Divine revelation, it really does, because I can, you know, I can believe that in a few isolated cases this may occur, where suddenly the whole thing, you know, blossoms out. But my personal belief is that to truly understand something, to say you have learned it, involves systematic study and a great deal of time, and that's all. After you put the time in, it's a very rare person who can have this revelation without doing anything. And the time element is just, it's impossible right now. You're probably right in a few cases.
Yes, a few cases.
These are probably people
now,
who probably were not aware of it. Self-consciously throughout the quarter, but it was gradually building up in them.
No, they weren't.
No, I mean they weren't aware that they actually, you know, knew where they were.
Yeah.
Until all of a sudden it dawned on them.
Well, now look. St. Paul was a theologian before he saw the light on the Damascus Road. Who is this man, Wesley, John Wesley? You see, he had gone through theological school and had all the experience behind him before he saw the light at that little place in Aldgate Street, Alder Street, what do they call it? Luther, you see, Luther had been one of the head priests, monks, or whatever he was, learned, active, before he got that light, you see, from Romans.
professional people. Why don't you talk about us common people?
Well, you see, the nature of the course is different.
Yes, the infinitude of the private man that, you know, yeah. We should blossom out suddenly.
Yeah.
But I don't, you know, don't pretend to be thorough or anything like that. I just plug away.
Yeah. But if I teach Emerson, I've got to be Emersonian.
Yeah, but you can't expect your students to react in an Emersonian manner, can you?
Yeah.
No, you're expecting too much.
No.
I really, you know, it'd be interesting to find out exactly what those people think of that definition of genius. Because, I mean, when I first read it, it's not a great deal of, you know, the first time you read it, the third time, fifth time. It's changed a great deal.
Yeah.
I think, like, I don't know, here I am advising you on what to do with the next class, but, you know, I think
well,
when you do get to that...
That's why I'm sitting here talking with you. I want to hear what you want to say.
Well, I think when you do get to that, I think you should, Well, I think you did. You brought it up. It's just like maybe you couldn't force everybody to say something. Maybe you have to ask them to write on it. I don't know what. But to trace the development of how this concept of genius changes, as you know, just rereading what Emerson said about it. Because the first time you reread it, you entirely reject it. And gradually you come to see. But, you know, I think that's a very important thing, as I look back in retrospect.
And I see what you're doing now is...
This is the end of the tape on Channel 2 Right, on Channel 2 Right for the 31st of May, 1968, the last day of class. Now I'll turn it over to Channel 2.